"Oh, such a good time as we have had!" exclaimed Mehitable as she came rushing into the cabin with James and her sister. 21 scholars," added her sister under considerable excitement. "Mr. Sanders' children are there, and they have twice as far to go as we have. They have to walk over 3 miles." "How did Jimmy get on at school?" inquired her mother, as soon as there was a place for her to put in a word. "He liked it," answered Mehitable. "He said his letters, and he asked the master how he knew that the letter R was R." "Just like him," ejaculated Thomas, laughing outright. Thomas had just come in, leaving his work when he saw the children return. "The master will have enough to do to answer all his questions. What did the master tell him?" "He told him that he learned it was R at school, when he was about as old as he was," replied Mehitable. And Thomas was giving Jimmy a toss in the air by way of sport, while she was relating the facts, and Jimmy himself was making a most vigorous attempt to embellish the occurrences of the day from his imperfect vocabulary. "How did you like your ride, Jimmy?" inquired Thomas. "Me like it," was the child's answer, uttered in a gleeful way. "You liked it better than Hit did, I guess."
"I liked it well enough," responded Mehitable.
"Weren't you awful tired?"
"I wasn't tired much."
"Did you carry him all the way?"
Pretty much. He walked a little of the way home. He isn't much of a load."
"Did he sit still in school?"
"Pretty still. He left his seat once and went over to scrape the acquaintance of another boy opposite."
"What did the master say?"
"He took him by the hand and led him back, looking at us and smiling, and he told him that each boy and girl had his own seat in school and he must keep it."
"You're a great one, Jimmy," exclaimed Thomas, tossing the little midget into the air again. "You'll make music for them in school."
"Well, children, I am glad that you like your school so well," remarked their mother, who had been listening to the prattle with maternal interest. "You must make the most of it, too, for we can't expect many school advantages in these woods. Poor opportunities are better than none."
James enjoyed no better opportunities of religious worship than we have described before he was 10 years of age. Occasional worship was a privilege that he highly prized, as others did. He did not readily let slip an opportunity to attend public worship, and the impressions it left upon his heart were gauged by his deep interest in such occasions. Whether there was any meeting or not, however, the weekly Sabbath was recognized in the Garfield cabin. No labor upon that day except works of necessity was the rule carefully observed. The Bible stood in place of preacher. It was both read and studied. Mrs. Garfield's rule was to read 4 chapters daily on weekdays and more on the Sabbath, when she formally expounded it in her sensible and thoughtful manner. The children asked questions as well as she. James was especially inquisitive about the Scriptures, and after he learned to read, he read them much, both on the Sabbath and weekdays. Bible stories that he learned from his mother's lips before he could speak plainly became invested with new charms when he could read them at his leisure. He became so familiar with many narratives that he knew just where in the Bible to turn to them, and he had a multitude of questions to ask about God's book, as his mother reverently called it. In the Lyceum, he early took rank far above the others as a speaker and debater. His interest in public matters was growing with the excitement of the times. The infamous fugitive slave law for the restoration of runaway slaves to their masters had been enacted by Congress as a compromise measure, and no people of the country felt more outraged by the attempts to enforce the act than the people of the Western Reserve. The excitement became intense. Young men partook of it in common with older citizens. It pervaded the higher schools. School and village lyceums received an impetus from it. James was an uncompromising foe to slavery before. If possible, he was more so now. The excitement fired him up in debate. He was more denunciatory than ever of slavery. He had been a great admirer of Daniel Webster, but his advocacy of the Fugitive Slave Bill awakened his contempt. He was not a young man to conceal his feelings, and so his utterance was emphatic. "A covenant with death and an agreement with hell," he exclaimed, quoting from Isaiah, "that will destroy the authors of it. The cry of the oppressed and downtrodden will appeal to the Almighty for retribution like that of the blood of Abel. The lightning of divine wrath will yet shiver the old, gnarled tree of slavery to pieces, leaving neither root nor branch." After 34 ineffectual ballots for a candidate, about 50 members of the convention cast their votes for James A. Garfield in the 35th ballot.
The announcement created a furor of excitement, as it indicated a breaking up of the factions and a probable union of all upon the most popular Republican in the convention. Instantly, the delegates of one state seized their banner with a shout. The delegates of each state sat together, their banner bearing the name of their state, bore it proudly forward, and placed it over the head of the aforesaid patriot and statesman, followed by other delegations and still others, until 700 delegates upon the floor and 15,000 spectators in the galleries joined in the remarkable demonstration, and cheer upon cheer rent the air as the banners one after another were placed in triumph over the head of their hero, declaring to the world without the use of language that James A. Garfield was the choice of the convention for President of the United States. The magnificent ovation terminating by the several bands striking up rally round the flag, 15,000 voices joining in the chorus, and a section of artillery outside contributing its thundering bass to the outburst of joy. It was a wild, tumultuous scene of excitement, the spontaneous outburst of patriotic devotion to the country, such as never transpired in any political assembly before, and probably never will again.